in his journals. They were confiscated when he entered the prison. Well, then, they are gone. Marvel shrugged. Our common practice is to destroy the belongings of the condemned. Tygo closed his eyes like he was in pain. Of all the idiotic excuses, Sousa exclaimed. I simply disbelieve it. You expect me to believe that all prisoners' effects are burned with the trash? I don't expect you to believe anything. This prisoner is only a walking doctor. Why should we keep his filth around? He is to be executed forthwith. Sousa, growing ever more annoyed, looked from Tygo to Juniper, who seemed somewhat bewildered, then came forward alone and spoke in a low voice. Very well. I should have known you would have some bureaucratic reason for doing what you do. The prisoner's second prediction is more sensitive, and I've already sent someone to find out if it's true. Now he whispered, The prisoner has informed me that all the ladies in the compound are bleeding in the feminine way. Marvel knitted his brow. What? They are bleeding in the feminine way. Marvel stared at Tygo. Tygo met his gaze evenly. Those ears were the mystagogue's work, or at the very least, an apostle of his, which meant Tygo's presence could not be accidental. The mystagogue's priests did not simply run away. There was no escape from that place. It was indeed strange that three monumental things had occurred at once. The comet, the outlaw carnival, and now this man who claimed he could heal people and predict things. Marvel's blood turned. He must secure his pardon. There was absolutely no going without it. He was too superstitious now in his old age to risk his salvation. He said, Your name is William Tygo. Do I have that right? A name I have is William Tygo. You're a surgeon. Tygo looked at Sousa before he looked at Marvel again, a fact that did not escape him. The very best. My mother was Gimbal, the witch, they called her. She crossed the continent in her youth. You won't have heard of her, you being religious lunatics, but others will have. He glanced at Juniper hopefully, but the young guard stared directly ahead. You can perform surgery. With my eyes closed. He nodded. I have a task for you then. A very important person in this palace is in need of a complicated surgery. You will do it. Perhaps in the process you will save your own life.
No, no, interrupted Sousa. I doubt he is a surgeon, but I'm beginning not to doubt that he's a visionary. And I must have my proof. Today, I want an answer about the bleeding.
Marvel chuckled. You are very much in demand, William Tygo. It couldn't be that you say what you need to say in order to please whatever person you are trying to win over. Never that, eh? Tygo smiled. Of course it's that. So you admit you are not a surgeon?
Marvel raised his eyebrow. This is incredible, Sousa said. The time we are wasting. I will go to Michael myself this instant if you do not release Tygo into my custody. You know I'll do it, and you know Michael will take my side.
He was right, of course. Michael was obsessed with the horoscopes Sousa drew for him on a nearly daily basis, no matter how Marvel had tried to dissuade him from the practice. In Marvel's experience, horoscopes relied nearly entirely on their interpreter. This was why the mystagogue had hated them. When John Sousa interpreted them, they contained all the deleterious possibilities the heavens could dream up. Marvel frowned at the disagreeableness of the situation. Then he frowned at Tygo, the hard nubs of his eyes boring into the smaller man like parasites. It was better not to involve Michael at all right now. Michael's gullibility would make things harder for Marvel. The king would ask, simply, why it was so important that Marvel send an illegal doctor to the Pardonus, and Marvel would have no answer. In a black mood, he dismissed them,
but not before Susa's messenger burst in with the news that the ladies of the palace were bleeding, each one, profusely. At his words, Susa turned somewhat dazedly to Tygo, who had gone motionless. Susa winced.
Ah, it is true, then. I don't know if I had expected it to be true. Well, he laughed softly.
The messenger informed the room that Queen Alison was very keen to hear the reason for their bleeding. Incredibly, Susa turned to Marvel as if for guidance. Tygo appeared to have sprouted a glitter of wetness in his eyes.
What are you waiting for? Marvel growled. My daughter has summoned you.
I'm hardly ready to see the Queen. My clothes... And I must take Tygo back to Urania so we can begin work. The return.
You are an idiotic man, Susa. If you've gotten what you wanted and yet still refuse to take it, I have absolutely no sympathy for you.
He stood and smoothed his cassock down over his legs.
Leave me.
They did not move. At last he stormed to the door, beckoning Juniper to follow him.
Tygo. You will answer to me after this interview. Mark that. My man will come for you. I will hear your story. I should have heard it in the jail when I first had the chance.
He slammed the door. Should have indeed. Marvel Whiteside Parsons decided in that moment that he hated John Susa. He hated Michael. All of them.
He wanted only to be a good man. To pray in peace at the center of the universe. He wanted to be away from them all, but through some confluence of duty and curiosity and filial love, he had not brought himself to leave.
When he reached the bottom of the tower and burst onto the world again, it was nearly dark. The sky above was the color of a rotten lime, striated with thin, wintry clouds. And there was the comet, the Stella Nova, Susa had called it. Juniper looked up, too, his face unreadable.
"Do you think it could be the shuttles?" he asked.
"That's what folk are saying. Even the outlaws."
"How do you know what the outlaws are saying?"
"I heard some other guards say that. I don't know if it's true."
Marvel did not reply. For the briefest moment, he entertained the thought that the incredible light was a harbinger of deepest darkness. A comet. A last burn of radiance before a final calamity befell the Earth and humankind. It must happen sometime. Perhaps now. The thought was black, and he liked its blackness, reveled in it for a few precious moments before he shook it off.
Take Tygo to the Pardoness whenever Susa is finished. Send me a message when you are there with him, and I'll come.
Juniper nodded. Marvel went to find Michael. The king would hear what Marvel wanted him to hear before he heard anything from anyone else.
Chapter 10 The Carnival. Upon the advent of darkness, the landscape of the camp was studded with bright diadems, each lonesome fire leaping up and up into the gathering dusk, inviting booth dwellers to gather around them, murmuring and warming themselves as they waited for the ceremony. The girls stared out on them from the warmth of their tent, which was set higher than the others because Mr. Capellatio would be the king. She listened to crones behind her fixing dandelion tea and then sipping it ponderously. Their slurping gave her comfort as she contemplated just how many people were spread out before her in this dimly lit carnival of carnivals. Waiting for her to become queen. She felt the weight of her iridescent black wedding dress, which flowed down her legs and pooled about her feet on the beautiful carpets covering the ground. She had never dreamt of anything so luxurious in her life. She had never known things like this fabric could exist. All she'd owned herself had come first from her mother, and that was little enough, then from Argento, who never gave her anything of value except Cosmas the Head, whose forehead was now embroidered with the unicursal hexagram and the third eye spell, so she couldn't even trust him not to tell her secrets.
But Mr. Capellatio had given her so many things already. This dress and jewels and hats with feathers, and even a pair of azure gloves he said were 400 years old.
"Do you know how old that is? Can you imagine that?"
he'd asked, and she had answered no. She could not imagine. He told her they were made from a kind of plastic fabric, so delicate that she must never wear the gloves, or even touch them, for fear they might flake away to nothing. He'd shown them to her one night, while the carnival was still on the road. He opened a glass box inlaid with smooth, bright blue rocks, and displayed the gloves to her with great care. They lay upon a soft pillow. He lifted them ever so gently up and turned them over and over in his hands before finally placing them in a different box, this time the one where he kept her other belongings, the black amber brooch, the head of Cosmas. He locked it and put it high on a shelf where she couldn't reach it. He said she would wear the gloves only one time when they ascended into the heavens, so it wouldn't matter then if they disintegrated, because they would disintegrate anyway, because of the shining force of the light and beauty that would envelop them and raise them up. The girl thought the words insane, but beautiful when he spoke them. She stood at the tent flap now, running her fingers over the watery texture of her dress, almost obsessively, as she gazed out at the land. Orchid had been forced by the crones to finish her preparations in her own tent, and had not taken the hardbound book because it did not belong to her. The girl felt the strange book at her back now, nearly pulsing with importance. She had been enjoying it, all the fantastical stories she had never heard before. But then she'd discovered it had been written by that woman. She went over to Mr. Capellatio's desk and opened the book again, though she did not know why. The first page said, "The True King, by an Executionatrix. New ages shall be rung in like thunder by a perfect mind." She flipped through the pages, the words spilling across them perfectly formed. The girl could read, but she could write nothing but the inane sigils her brother had forced her to learn, curses and charms. What could that verse mean? Where had it come from? What did any of it mean? Why had he had a wife already and not told her? She was jealous again. She closed the book. Soon, all around her came the low singing of the men and the sounds of cooking and eating as the carnivalers enjoyed their evening meals. But there was more. Among the tents and booths, there were other wagons, heavier ones, pulled by big horses that now stood hobbled here and there between campsites, with bags of feces swaying heavily at their backsides. And these wagons were loaded with clubs and maces and guns, and the girl knew, but oh, hadn't she known since the beginning, that Mr. Capellatio's carnival was here to make war, and that other carnivals had come to join him in the war, and all at once she felt a certainty that the war would begin tonight. It would begin with the marriage, because he had been waiting for proof of his own divinity, and he believed she was that proof. Maybe if she did not marry him, there would be no war. Maybe he would give up and return to wherever he came from, a hut on a beach, maybe. He might slink off in the night and live out his life as an ordinary executioner. Maybe she and Orchid wanted the same thing, for her not to be the queen. She tugged at her dress again. It was so tight and hot. Then a restless breath seemed to pour across the carnival at once, like a bird flock rising in a single heaving motion. The people were drawn like puppets from their fire rings to the center aisle, and the girl squinted into the darkness and saw that it was Mr. Capellatio himself at whom they were staring, striding across the camp toward his tent. He seemed to wave when he caught sight of her silhouette in the doorway. She glanced over her shoulder to be sure he was not addressing someone else, but of course he was waving at her. She was about to marry him. When he came closer, she could see he was smiling. She thought she could number every tooth in his smile,
They had touched their faces together so many times already in the early half-lit mornings when he would rest his head under her chin and hold her very tightly. She felt she knew every place on him by heart. He was dressed for the wedding, in clothes she couldn't have imagined before this moment. When he reached her, he took her hands in his. "Do you like my clothes, Queenie?" She couldn't stop staring at them. He did a little turn for her and then bowed. "These are real shark skin, from a real marsh shark," he said, pointing to the pants. They were smooth and dove gray, and so soft-looking. She nodded. He laughed quietly. "Do you like your dress?" She said nothing. He smiled wider. "That's why I love you, my almost wife. You don't need to talk to make your point. At first, I was confused by it, but now I see this is precisely why we are a match made in heaven. It makes me gladder than you can know." He hugged her close, and she wrapped her arms around his body, which was strong and warm. She could feel the smoothness of their fabrics rubbing together. He gathered up a handful of the dress and shook it at her. "Silk," he said, as though the word itself were magic. And who knew? Perhaps it was. "Come, my bride. Let us be married." They clasped hands again, and he led her across the carnival, picking his way through tent poles and staked heads, and all the grotesqueries that accompanied the making of heads, the basins of herbed water, the sand pits where they dried, and also they walked past ropes hung with curing meat, past herds of tiny goats, past a teenage boy with a bow and arrow who gazed at the girl with undisguised lust. She had just met eyes with him when Mr. Capellatio pulled her along more roughly. They passed many faces, hopeful, skeptical, kind, hungry. The insistent attention began to make her even more nervous, so she kept her face down, watching the flame light and the shadows twisting together on the ground while they walked, and she concentrated on lifting her skirt high enough to keep from tripping. Onlookers soon began to follow them as they proceeded out of the camp. Suddenly, bewilderingly, a sizable group had fallen in behind them, following them toward the ocean. The people in these carnivals were wilder than the ones in Argento's, with tangled hair and faces painted like stars. Some of them wore hardly any clothes. Others were dressed in full robes and crystal crowns. They even seemed to walk with more purpose than the people in her brother's carnival, like they had something to lose. A crowd surrounded them now. Many of them kept looking from her to the sky, and when she too looked up, she saw, almost directly above her head, a bend of light arcing toward the earth. A returning rocket? Just as Mr. Capellatio had said? It was brighter than she'd imagined. Or a comet. She had never seen one, but she had not imagined it would look like this, purple-white and motionless, like a held breath. She kept her hand loose in Mr. Capellatio's as they walked. The soft mumbling of the crowd passed from her attention, as did all things except that light, and she watched it slowly burn for what felt like the longest moment, while inside her chest rose up a noise. In time, she realized it was the pounding of her heart. What terrible wonder could this be? What reckoning spilling over the heavens? And in spite of herself, she felt of a piece with it, this light, for it had brought her with it to this place, on this night, as if it had been destined forever, as if it had existed always. Chapter 11 Queen Alison. John had met Queen Alison many times, and yet each meeting renewed his terror of her, not because she was herself terrifying, but because she burned with a need to understand. Not him, no, and not his work, and nor did she seek a definite prophecy about the return or the endless remedial horoscope calendars her husband Michael so loved. But there was something fixed and slow and deep about her that caused him to trip up his words, to poorly explain even the most explicable events, to stumble about her chamber like a hyperactive child, sweeping his arms along with the peaks and valleys of his lecture. He lectured her. He could not help it, and her appearance of boredom never failed to horrify him. She mostly called upon him to explain practical things. Why, for instance, were all the ladies of the palace bleeding at once? Tygo waited in the hallway in the care of another lion-masked guard, who had yanked him hard by the arm to stop him from entering the queen's grand chamber, as though Tygo posed some immediate threat, although it seemed plain to John that he did not. This evening, John faced Queen Alison alone. She was gazing at him with her I-dare-you eyes, the way he assumed she must look at everyone. For what was he to her? A weak sneeze of a man. The king, although nearly middle-aged now, was broad and somewhat tall. Alison was his second wife. The first queen, Rachel, had fallen from one of the palace minarets, or that's what everyone said, and frankly, John had not cared for her either. She'd been inbred as a lapdog, and ugly as well. Alison seemed somewhat young, but John was not certain she was. She had the sort of face that could exist mostly untouched for several decades, with faint lines and freckles across the forehead exacerbated by smoking, which she did in excess, and was doing at the moment, holding her slender moonstone pipe a foot and a half from her lips. Her hair was the darkest brown and straighter than a normal person's hair. Another artifact of inbreeding? He suspected. She was the daughter of Marvel Parsons, but cared little for magic or ceremonies. She preferred to spend her time at golf.
"Your beauteousness, forgive us. Your discomfort was not our intent."
She watched him. "Okay." Her pipe adularest when she drew smoke through it, a throbbing opal, blue with gem light. "I didn't say it was." He squirmed.
"Oh, yes. Well."
The queen waited. She had a girl's manner of waiting for him to speak first, a paroxysm of disinterest upon her, even when she herself had asked the question. He wondered how she thought of him, if she thought of him at all. Her life was in every way a mystery to him. What did she do all day? The vast room she occupied in the Southeast Tower, Columbia, was the same room her predecessor had lived in, but Alison had removed every trace of the other woman, pinks, whites, sparkles on everything, in favor of a terrific and startling blue, and azure paint accented by cobalt rock crystal. Around the room, clear indigo geodes spilled light from clusters of beeswax candles situated behind them. And there were more candles. Candles everywhere. There must have been 100 around her sitting area alone. Whenever John stood in her chamber, he smelled something impossible to describe, but that nevertheless described perfectly her entire existence, her experience since birth, a scent wholly hers, and one he had never smelt in another place. A detached butterfly wing? The paint on the eyelid of a statue? Something powdery. Something mineral. Alison's life, her tenuous hold on the truth of the world, the terrible, stinking, gross world that John admittedly only glimpsed on his infrequent journeys to the palace compound, at times struck him as unbearably frivolous. And yet she did fascinate him. In the corner, one of her small black dogs slept in an elevated bed shaped like a saucepan.
"Your Majesty, how shall I begin? We did not cause the bleeding."
His voice splattered into the space between them, like vomit into a bowl.
"It happened in spite of us. Believe me, I would have done anything I could to spare you and every lady of the court such extreme extra unpleasantness, had I known such a thing was happening."
"Us? We? Who is we?" Her face like a wide, freckled ancient head, a feminine votive.
"My new predictive assistant and myself. That's the title I've given him for the moment. I've only lately acquired him."
He heaved his arm in front of himself in gesture of affirmation he recognized as overdrawn even as he performed it. Who was he in front of her? The palace fool? and still he could not stop grinning like a maniac. His dimples hurt.
This new assistant, he's a damn sight more intuitive than I am, that's for certain. You may not know, but I'm very, very poor at predictions myself, or at least ones that aren't strictly astrological. Now, certainly, I could tell you if the day of your birth is auspicious, or I could tell you when it might be fortuitous to conceive a son.
Was he talking about her womb? Was he imagining her beneath the girthy heft of their blonde king, a hairy-backed board of a man? John had read the king's horoscopes to him in his bath many times. Allison lying back under his spermy exuberance? He swallowed.
You might have asked Michael if I...
We never talk about you, she said, turning to her little black dog and scrunching her brow absently. She took a puff of her pipe. Michael has his obsessions. A shrug. The dog caught her gaze and wagged hopefully, stepping out of its round bed.
John's hands seemed unable to sweat properly. They felt numb to him, weirdly flaccid.
The dog crossed the room diagonally from the back, and when it reached Allison's couch in the center, she kicked it playfully away. And when it would not retreat, she waved at one of her serving women to hold it.
Michael talks about a lot of things. I just tell him to shut up.
She turned her head back to John.
I asked him about this bleeding, though, and he said I should ask you.
So, Lord Astronomer, what can you tell me? She held up her own hand and studied each knuckle carefully.
Wait, did you just say you have an assistant now? Is that what you were talking about?
When John had been a boy, he'd spent many an hour in what could only be called hypnotic fascination, the study of tiny things. A garden lizard, fear-frozen on a coral statue, a swatch of fabric on his trouser leg, an engraved medallion his mother often wore, which became his after her death. Objects obvious and present to a boy, woefully unpresent to him as a grown man. He'd never concerned himself with time until it had already passed. When he was young, he'd nabbed that medallion from his mother for a few hours, studied the slender figures depicted upon it. Two women seated on a chaise lounge, a guinea hen, emblem of the family Sousa, scratching at the ground before them. John had dismissed easily the most obvious questions a child might ask about the scene. Who the women were didn't interest him, but how they got onto the medallion did. What person or tool had machined them there so smoothly? And then there was the matter of the age of the metal. He'd sent his boy's fingers around and around it, so even and smooth it was, as though the medallion itself might answer him. The skill necessary to make such an object had astonished him, even then. John the adult was no different, only now he spent his time studying invisible magics. But had he not once studied his own knuckles, as Allison was just now doing, the marvelous utility of each bone nub straining against the skin, and each mole and each sparse shaft of hair? He stared at her. She waited patiently, content, it seemed, to contemplate her hand and then him, watching him teeter from side to side, having got lost inside himself on his way to an answer. Her nails were painted, each one a different color, short and practical. At last, she snapped her fingers to catch his attention.
John panicked. Yes, my assistant. He is an unorthodox choice, I confess, and he has spent some time in prison. This prison, in fact, only recently. Terribly recently, but I have cause to believe that his predictive abilities are remarkable. You see, it was Tygo who advised that I inquire about your... bleeding.
The word was difficult for him to say.
I asked him to perform a feat of prediction as a test. His, employment, shall we say, was contingent on the fulfillment of his prediction. And before you ask, let me inform you that I have not, as of yet, proven that Tycho did not do some magic of his own to cause his prediction to become true. But as we speak, I'm working on it. I am as certain as I can be that Tycho is honest. Would you like to meet him?
What? She asked. Still, she looked at her nails.
Would you like to meet Tycho? He's outside. Shackled, of course.
Technically, you must be aware, he's still a prisoner. I ask permission from you to take him before the Pardoness. A royal pardon would unburden me greatly and legitimize our work.
And keep the Hierophant away from him, he did not say. He stuffed his hands into the pockets of his coat, felt a rip in the lining of the left one. He knew he would forget to ask Mizar to mend it until he lost something precious through the hole. Allison put her hands to her temples.
You're so hard to follow. Are you telling me the man who caused the bleeding is here now, outside my chamber?
Not caused, John piped. Predicted.
Whatever. Yes, bring him in right now. I want to see him.
She held up a hand.
Wait.
She spoke to her handmaid.
Get the sheets.
The handmaid returned, her arms piled high with white sheets stained with russet blobs. John stared, uncomprehending. The young woman cast the sheets onto the tiled floor, spreading them out with a toe so they were all more or less visible, hills and valleys in a circle around her own rose-colored dress. There were at least 7 or 8 sheets, each ruined by brown-red smears. John knew Allison, always inexpressive, was watching him. As he realized what the stains were, a blush mounted his face.
This is gross, she said finally. Just gross. You know it is.
The handmaid had at last spread out each sheet, and John could see the extent of the havoc.
Could normal women bleed so much and yet be unharmed?
Allison said, They can be washed, but the laundress says they'll never get completely white. I know I won't want to sleep on these, and Michael won't want to sleep or do anything on these. And other than the handmaids and servants, I don't know a single girl who won't need new bedclothes. And who's paying for that? Are you? And, she pulled on one of the 2 straight curtains of her hair, which divided and fell onto each shoulder.
As a side note, Lord Astronomer, when you're talking, I immediately start thinking about something else. I used to think it was me, but I actually think it's you. Don't they have some kind of class you can take to get better at it?
He wondered what they she referred to, and felt his blush ripen.
Part of your job is to explain things to me when I wish them explained, right? But it's like you're speaking a different language. You do this thing where you start in the middle and then I'm lost.
Your Majesty, you're paying for these sheets. It's coming from your salary.
I insist. You were saying something about an assistant?
He was dazed. The handmaid still fussed with the sheets, using first her left foot and then her right to swab them into some unintelligible order. The heft and locomotion of them across the floor.
All the blood. Oh, might the women have died? Had Tygo magicked them after all? His mouth moved.
My assistant? She huffed.
This is what I mean. You were just saying.
Yes, my lady queen, of course. May I bring him in? I am sorry to say that only he can aptly explain it to you. Forgive me for everything. I'll pay 100 times over. I'll pay for all this.
Yes, okay,
she sighed, glancing at the door. John called for the guard to produce Tygo, handcuffed again, but this time with his feet unbound. He came right into the room as though he had been waiting for just this chance to explain everything. His 2 large pants gaped at the waist and dragged slightly on the floor. John noticed again then how uncommonly short Tygo was, and yet he did not seem short. Nor did he appear to have any misgivings about this or any situation John had yet observed him in. Tygo smiled at the queen, a quick and dazzling smile, and John could not understand the look that momentarily crossed her face.
Amusement?
Hello, she said.
Hello,
he said, still smiling. She waited for Tygo to speak, but he said nothing. John wished he were standing closer so he could nudge him.
Didn't he sense that Allison did not like speaking first?
But Tygo waited and waited. His smile slowly slid down his chin and left his body altogether. Allison narrowed her eyes at him palely.
John had often noticed she looked nothing like her rumpled, stocky father, Marvel. He saw no hint of her father in her, except in her eyes. So very pale green, like diluted sulfurous nuggets, chalky and impermeable. They remained on her earless guest like veils, opaque partitions separating her soul from her face. Allison gazed without blinking at Tygo, and at last, with no hint of retreat in her voice, she asked, "You are?"
"Tygo Brachio. Or people have called me the Peacock, or William Tygo, or one of 100 other names. Didn't the Lord Astronomer tell you? I'm his new assistant."
She laughed.
Laughed?
Her cheeks crowded upward and forced her eyes into small crescents. Now it was she who blushed as her laughter left off, and still she looked at Tygo most intently, unconcerned, it seemed, with the livid pulsation in her face.
"You're both dressed terribly," she said. "Didn't you have anything nicer to wear to visit the Queen?"
Tygo pulled a handful of dull fabric free from his chest and let it fall back again.
"Servant's clothes was all they gave me. I don't know his excuse. Also, I didn't expect the Queen to be a smoker. You must smoke all the time. It smells like it."
She ducked her head indignantly and waved her blue pipe with her other hand, dispersing the haze around her.
"I can do what I want. I'm the Queen."
"I'm only saying it's bad for you."
He smiled again. John's stomach dropped.
"Your beauteousness. I apologize again."
Allison ignored John and leaned forward.
"You don't know that?"
Tygo shrugged.
"No, I do. I also knew you would all be bleeding. And here we are. You want to know why you're all bleeding, right?"
"Do you know?"
"The question you're asking is really, did I do it? Am I right in assuming that?" "And the short answer is no, of course not. It's not possible for me or any other person, magician or otherwise, to fix it so you and all your ladies..."
He looked pointedly at John then, but John would not meet his eyes. Tygo straightened and enunciated.
"Are bleeding at once. That's the medical term. The discharge of blood from your bodies is not caused by magic. That's not my opinion. It's a simple truth. Now, I don't want to have a discussion about politics, so we should agree to disagree here. But let me promise you, Queen Allison, I don't do magic. The astronomer and I have covered this at length."
"Well, did he do it?"
she said, with a cursory nod in John's direction.
"From my admittedly short experience with him, I'll say that he doesn't do magic either. He spends most of his time with his instruments."
"His what?"
"Telescopes, astroblades, charts,"
Tygo replied, with a wink at the Queen so quick John could hardly believe he saw it.
"Math."
She smirked.
"John Sousa, in my mind, is always doing spells or stabbing birds through the throat or something like that to make his predictions. But you're saying he doesn't?"
It was as though the little hideous man had put John over a burner, and steam rose up through the top of his head.
"I perform calculations based on numbers our forefathers collected many years ago," he said through a tight mouth. "I would have been delighted to show you. I could easily make up a simple series of predictions while you look on..."
"Oh, God, no." She was laughing again now. "No, please, it's okay."
John's face went slack. Tygo smiled openly, and greater still was the joy in his eyes, precise dark pools with a black sheen, water at the bottom of a well. Allison said,
"At least Michael makes it sound interesting when he talks about it. Which is all the time, God."
She waved her hand, a swirl of multicolored nail tips.
"You were saying, Tygo Brachio?"
He stepped forward.
"I was saying this. Although it's well known to most walking doctors that women, when boarding together, will often begin to cycle together, we don't know why. There doesn't seem to be any accepted explanation, but a guess recorded in the books has been that the lead woman, the most fertile woman, that is, in the group, somehow changes the bodies of the subordinate women to bring menstruation in line with her own cycle."
She smirked, but said nothing. Tygo said,
But obviously, this is not what happened here, as you have all been living together for a long time. So whatever has caused the bleeding could only be something impressively out of order, a thing of the most extreme magnitude. He held up a finger. I'm sure you and your ladies have noticed the Stella Nova. Keenly she nodded.
We saw it earlier, and now they are saying there is another.
John heard this, but could make nothing of it.
Another one?
A deep distress began to crash within him, knocking his worries together like cylinders on a wind chime.
Another comet?
Tygo, too, appeared confused, but quickly blustered through it with a nod. They had just been outside, had they not? In the widening, luminous evening they had just ridden through, cut as it was by gray-purple clouds stacked atop one another, they had seen no trace of another comet.
Had they?
Even as John uneasily recalled the landscape from their carriage ride, he knew he had been distracted, and not at all in a state of mind to properly notice anything, least of all some new miraculous manifestation that was most likely hidden by clouds. He hadn't really looked up. He who should always be looking. He had read nothing in his books about a double comet. Not during this century. Oh, God, when had he last read up on comets? Would Mizar know? John looked about without realizing it. So used was he to Mizar clicking behind him in some spirit of helpfulness. Mizar had memorized almost as many of the charts as John, but his servant was nowhere to be seen, probably down taking a luxurious look at the exposed bodies on the east wall of the palace, holding his nose and cackling with some guard or another.
Yes, another one, said Tygo, and I'm sure you've already figured out what they must be.
Allison answered, a slight pursing of her lip betraying her puzzlement.
Of course it must be the shuttles returning, right? You're saying that's what's caused our bleeding?
Tygo began pacing in front of her. He hunched over just so, to indicate deep consideration, even a little confusion. John bristled in silence.
Yes, it may be the return, Tygo nodded slightly. When I predicted the bleeding, I was hoping to prove myself of immediate usefulness to the Lord Astronomer. I confess that it wasn't so much a prediction as it was a guess, an educated one. I was hoping he'd take me in, let me help him sort all this out, since he doesn't seem able to make heads or tails of the physical aspects of what's happening to you all. And,
Tygo held up his hand,
I admit, I wanted to save my own skin. I don't want to die, Your Majesty, just because I know a thing or two about the human body, just because I've done some surgeries in my day. Anyway, I figured such an extreme celestial event was bound to be affecting you ladies bodily. I even feel it in myself, he said, lowering his voice and moving his chained wrists near his waist. I tell you where, but, he shrugged, I wouldn't want to offend your dignities. I'm sure the Lord Astronomer concurs.
He looked over at John, eyebrows high, and then Tygo flashed one lid up and then down. Another wink, this time at John, and Allison could not have seen it, for Tygo was turned at that moment entirely toward John himself.
Would you agree, John?
He asked.
May I call you that, Lord Astronomer?
John? He leaned back toward the Queen and said in a low, conspiratorial tone,
We haven't even had time to discuss the formalities of our professional collaboration yet, but I think Lord Astronomer would agree that I've already made myself more than useful.
Agitated, John ran his dehydrated hands through his hair, which flopped back unworkably onto his forehead.
Tycho was lying to her.
He no more believed in the return of the shuttles than he believed in the efficacy of any magic, as he'd made plain on the carriage ride. He'd been cast into a jail cell precisely because of his heretical beliefs.
Why would he tell her it was the shuttles?
John felt he was losing track of some important thread, that he was watching it slip past him into the open world, and afterward that he would never see it again. The thread was his singular agency, that he would never draw back. Tygo even now was spinning out some story that made only the dimmest sense to John. To save his life,
to impress the queen. And why not? It was a performance. It struck him that Tiger was an actor more than anything else. He didn't understand anyone or anything around him. He found himself numbly agreeing with Tiger, even heard himself talking as if from a far-off prominence.
Yes, it must be the return. I have every evidence of it. The charts indicate, well, there is much to suggest that we should... In fact, your beauteousness, I was just about to insist that you bring the king thusly, or else we should go to him. This is the moment. We should begin making a plan of some kind.
Her face, inexpressive still. A plan for what? Tygo stepped between them.
We don't know, is what the Lord Astronomer is trying to say. What we're trying to say, both of us, is that please, please don't be distressed about the bleeding or any other vagaries of the body during this unique time. Something much more important is about to happen. Have you not wondered at the arrival of the enormous outlaw carnival?
They have their eye on it, she said slowly, knitting her brows. We've had uprisings before, like during the unrest. They never get inside the walls. Then she shrugged. Nothing comes of it in the end.
This may be different. Maybe they've come because they know it's the return. Who knows? Maybe they've come because they want to be here when it happens,
Tygo said. She bent forward excitedly.
What do you think will happen?
Tygo took his place by John. He was clearly closing the interview. An acrimonious bile rose in John's throat. Tygo had caught the queen's eye, and now was looking somewhat impertinently at her, in a way that John distrusted, leaning in to meet her with barely restrained interest. Her own eyes seemed to search every corner of Tygo's face, looking across the slope of his nose and up to those idiotic star tattoos, clustered like freckles on the left cheekbone.
Do we have your permission to keep at our magic?
Tygo asked.
Our work is important. John's right.
Her lips, full and small as two buttons, turned downward as she nodded. She said, You know those tattoos look stupid on you. I just noticed you have no ears. He bowed a little, and swung his arms as if to stretch them above his head, if they had been unchained.
Youth, he laughed. I had a good time, and then a very bad time. It's a common tale.
You'll come back in one day to tell me everything you've discovered?
Was she asking him?
Her lips parted, resolved themselves again into a perfect bud.
I'd tell you anything, my queen.
He smirked delicately. Tygo took John's sleeve and turned him physically toward the door. As they exited the chamber, they heard her giggling with her handmaiden, and then the dog was placed on the floor, and they heard its jubilant scrabbling as it raced after them. But before it reached their heels, the heavy white door slammed shut, and at John's side, Tygo had also begun laughing.
"I think she liked me, eh?"
he demanded.
"What a gorgeous creature she is. I can't stand it."
John glowered. Then they were walking alone past one of the immense windows at the top of the tower, and John stopped in a stupor, squinting.
Wait, it was there.
Just there in the gleaming dark, a second arc, faint to be sure, but soaring high in the sky not more than a few degrees from the first light. And beneath them, a growing mass of people had convened an outlaw carnival.
For what?
What reason could there be besides the obvious? There came over him the undeniable impression that all reason was leaking from the world, that he was a faucet, that through his miscalculations, all things would slowly but surely upend themselves.
What could these lights be, if not the shuttles?
It seemed fitting that after decades of failure, John, who had his whole life long desired truth and order, should now be reliant upon a con man, who may well have real visions.
Why shouldn't the truth, when it finally came to John Sousa, be revealed by a liar?
Chapter 12 The Wedding The way to the shoreline had been lit for them by a legion of the faithful. People lined the rocky path in a winding route that seemed meant to prolong their march to the sea. The surrounding crowd was innumerable in the half-light. Face after face turned to the girl in a euphoria of shared belief. Here a set of eyes that cried, there a pair of hands reaching to touch Mr. Capellatio or his betrothed. And somehow, she found she was on the cusp of sharing their hope. Excitement welled up inside her as she completed the final steps of the processional and arrived at the first dune, hand in hand with Mr. Capellatio. The ocean now was very loud, breaking only 100 yards in front of them. They mounted a weather-worn set of steps that crossed the dunes and fell down again onto the soft, pale beach. When their feet touched the sand, Mr. Capellatio whispered in her ear, "We've made it." And she didn't know if he meant to the sea or something else. At the base of the steps, they removed their shoes. Piked heads loomed all around, grinning deaths lit up by torches thrust in the sand between them, one after the other, all the way down to the foam of the ocean. The girl counted 30, 40 heads at least, all lined up opposing one another to form a kind of aisle, and wafting around them a tangle of streamers in the colors of his carnival, purple, red, orange. Beyond this, the people were all waiting in the darkness, all watching her. She was trembling, with excitement, confusion, damp in her armpits. They were going to walk down the center of the aisle. That was how weddings went. Mr. Capellatio took her face in his hands while they still waited. Shadows, colored like the inside of an eyelid, bounced across the sand at her feet. Suddenly, the crowd seemed quieter. There was whispering, the breathy sound of a wind instrument from some place close by, and the murmur of the ocean. It was only then she fully realized she was back. He had taken her home, just as he said he would. He had kept his word. He had taken her to the sea. It lay black and silver in front of them, like a wavering net. "Are you all right, Queenie?" he asked her softly. How could she answer? Her mouth yielded up some formation of the word, "Yes." And then he had his arms all around her in a happy daze. They swung together like dancers. As he spun her, she looked at everything. The beach beyond the throng of people was dark, until a mile away the east wall of the palace compound rose up, with cords of hanging lanterns strung from the four towers to Canaveral Tower in the center, so it formed what looked like the frame of a large carnival tent. It was beautiful indeed. And then Mr. Capellatio's lips found hers, soft, unbelievably so, and she was looking at his face and nothing else. So many people were watching them. He kissed her fiercely, and then they were cheering. He said in her ear, "Aurora, will you marry me?" Out of the sky came the warmest wind, and it stirred many emotions in her that threatened to bring her to tears. She did not know if she wanted to marry him, but she had accepted, forever ago now, it seemed, that she would. As far as she could disentangle one feeling from the next, she found she was flattered by his public kisses, and she was full of pride because he was the leader, and she was pleased with her own beautiful wedding dress as well as the delicate opalescent crown he had set upon her head to signify that she was queen. But mostly, she was thrilled at her place in the center of this crowd, buffeted by the blaze of torches and smells with him. The eyes made her shy, but she wanted them upon her. She nodded, "Yes." And at that he clapped his hands and thrust his hand high in the air together with hers and shouted, "The young sigil dressed in white! Here she is! Columbia Challenger Discovery Atlantis Endeavor!" Her loose sleeve sliding backward down the cylinder of her arm. The crowd cheered again, and the girl felt that this must be happiness. This, and if it was, then perhaps she had been happy all her life after all. So unsurprising was this feeling of inevitability and excitement. Just as they began their walk down the aisle of heads and streamers, a great globe of green light sprang up at the shore below, as though a lamplighter had been watching for a signal, as she and Mr. Capellatio passed some invisible marker. The path before them ran directly into the sea, and there at the seam where the ocean met the sand was a large raft, suddenly lit up brilliantly. A driftwood barge big enough to hold 3 people at least, and on the barge stood Orchid in her own fine dress, holding a burning torch in her hand that sent spirals of emerald light and shadow down her forearm, with her hair bound up on one of those stiff forms that the crones wore. She wore face paint like a crone. Her smile, when she saw them, was dreadful. The torch had been treated with some chemical that made it burn green. At the water, the girl hesitated, but Mr. Capellatio tugged her into the sea, which swirled around her ankles and billowed her dress between them, and when they were knee-deep, he boosted her up onto the raft, which must have been anchored because it remained in place despite the jostling. The girl stood for a moment alone with Orchid, who glared without a shred of sympathy. She offered no encouraging word, not even a nod of acknowledgement. The girl looked at her, and Orchid, hard-eyed, looked back over the umber stripes on her cheekbones. Once Mr. Capellatio ascended the raft, and they'd all regained their balance, he laughed and exclaimed, "My wives! My hearts!" It was such a jubilant laugh. The torch in Orchid's hand winked in the breeze, and she set it in a brace bolted to the back of the raft. The crowd massed at the waterline. They stood shoulder to shoulder, and the low pitches of their voices were no longer audible. She felt the raft straining against its hidden tethers with the tide. Orchid moved closer to Mr. Capellatio. "Are we really going to do this, David? You can still stop this hideousness. I'll say anything you want me to say to them, but stop it." She paused. Though she was begging, she did not sound like it. Her voice, the girl noticed, was quite high. "I need time to read the texts again. There is a mistake in my interpretation." "Read your lines," he replied, forcing her slightly away from him with his thigh. "I will not," she hissed. "I cannot. This is too awful." It seemed to the girl that Mr. Capellatio might strike Orchid, but the scowl passed nearly instantly, and he grasped the girl by her hand again and stroked the inside of her wrist. "My radiance," he said to Orchid. "Wife of my first heart." "Quiet with that," she whispered. "I will not do this, David. Tell them that she is a sacrifice to the great work. Say that you will marry her here and now, and then we will make her a head, together. She is our great sacrifice. Look, I've brought my knife." She lifted her dress and exposed her tall leather boots, the ones she had been wearing earlier. Poking from the left one, just visible up against her pale thigh, was a knife handle. "I've read the scriptures over and over today, and I cannot agree with you. You are not supposed to take another queen. You are making an erroneous interpretation. Please forgive me for saying this, but perhaps it's brought on by your fear of what is to come. David, my dear husband, my spiritual master, whom I have loved with all my heart since I was a girl." That was not so long ago. "I am not that old. Please listen to me. We both know how afraid you have been of these days, of our work coming to its apex. Let us at least admit that. Can you admit it?" She stared at him imploringly. He said nothing. "Fear has clouded your vision." She raised her voice. The folds of the silk around Orchid's thigh, the handle of the knife catching the light as she bent forward ever so slightly. The girl saw it. Mr. Capellatio was watching her leg, too. He was barefoot, as was the girl. Orchid swayed as she spoke, then spun her hands in an odd circular motion. The girl wondered if she was trying to conjure something. "Husband, I cannot see as I once could. I grant you that. But my intellect hasn't changed. My talent hasn't lessened. I am still your glassine prism, refracting your dreams into words for the world." He nodded. "Yes, you are.
and this girl is my gemrock, my possession of highest worth. We are all the things we are. I am the king. She is a living sigil who ushers in our success, who appears at the perfect time, and who